And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and today I'm joined by Alex and Wesley Orbison, who, along with their brother, Roy Jr., have written the book, The Authorized Roy Orbison. Thanks so much for joining us today, guys.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Now, Alex, what made this the right time to release a book about your father?
Honestly, it was just when it ended. You know, this has been such a long process to have this book come into fruition. And actually, my dad really, really wanted to have a book for himself and had tinkered with the idea and then the actual writing of it. And that must have been in the middle of the 80s or something. And he got very busy toward the end of his life and so wasn't able to finish the book. And so we worked on this book for, God, you know, it's the last 3 or 4 years or something like that. And so there was no magic with the exact timing. It was just that we got it done. But we've, you know, this book has been so important for us as a family just because my dad had always let the music stand for itself and speak for itself. And so literally if you type in Roy Orbison for like a search on the web, it'll say like blind or albino. Like people have no idea about my dad in a general way. So the book's important to set the story straight in a lot of ways.
So when he was thinking about it in the 80s, you were a teenager. Were you paying much attention to that project?
You know, I thought that the idea of it would be very cool. And I had no idea how much time would go into getting it right and then making sure, you know, that the end phase of making it perfect from being right is it takes longer than I imagined. So, you know, I would be interested to read his firsthand accounts. And mostly it was the things that I learned about my dad being a young man are so interesting to me. A lot of his time here in Memphis in between going back and forth from Texas and Memphis is a lot of info that I didn't know.
Now, Wesley, you're the oldest of the three brothers that worked on this book. When did you first realize that your father was a world famous recording artist?
Well, it didn't take long because, you know, he was gone an awful lot. And so it was his, you know, singing career that kept him on the road so much. So pretty early on, I knew that he was busy all the time and it was hard to get a phone call through at times because he would be in London or Australia, you know, 4 to 8 hours, 10 sometimes, time difference, you know. So couldn't just call in the afternoon to say hello. And back then, the long-distance rates were really expensive, so you couldn't really have an in-depth conversation. So it was usually quick little bursts of hello and things like that as I was growing up. And then a couple of times, I'd go out with him, and he seemed to be pretty recognizable, you know, with the dark hair and the glasses that he wore all the time. It's even around home, you know, they didn't necessarily associate his name so much, but at least, you know, the image was always pretty pretty easy to recognize, you know.
Now, Elvis also was born with lighter colored hair, and mm-hmm. Roy was as well. What was behind the decision for him to dye his hair black?
No, I just think they thought it looked good, you know.
Yeah.
It might be after Bob Hope. So.
Yeah. Yeah, and one thing I noticed too was the fixation to stand out amongst the crowd. And I had read accounts of my dad dyeing his hair black very early, you know, and in between 56 and 7 or 55 and 6, and just trying to do something different to stand out of the crowd. And you know, with Blue Bayou, there were so many songs with blue in the title that they wrote a song, and Fred Foster said, "Oh well, no, there's another song with blue in it." And then by the third time they brought in Blue Bayou as a song, and they said, "We don't care how many blues there are," you know. So, and the advent of rock, I think, to stand out a little bit was, you know, was the goal.
Now, what was life like for the Orbison family in the 1930s in Texas?
Well, you know, the amazing thing about our family in the 30s is literally I think they just left, you know, with their hat on at one point and I had no idea how stretched thin you know everyone was through the Depression, you know, because if you're talking about the 30s, for me it's stock market crash in 29 and then just the Dust Bowl, which you know West Texas was right on the edge of. And there's a story of our grandparents walking from, is it Oklahoma to Texas?
Not sure.
Yeah, because Vernon's right on the border, right?
Yeah, yeah. And they found a pack of cigarettes, and there was one cigarette in there. And that was like a big deal at those times. So, yeah, yeah, just a lot of going from jobs to jobs for our papa, which is our grandpa, and kind of doing whatever whatever could get done. And combine that with a, you know, shortly after our dad was born, there was a polio epidemic. So it's like the kids are in one place and the parents in another. Definitely was crazy, crazy times in the world and for our family back then.
And in a strange coincidence, your grandfather's name was Orby Lee Orbison.
Mm-hmm.
And your father's best friend when he was young was named Orby Lee Harris.
I know. It's weird. And so my name's Alex Orby Lee Orbison as well. So there's another, it's amazing how many Orbies there are out there that, yeah. And if Orby.
And Grady Lee had an Orby as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I, you know, I don't know if Orby Lee Harris was completely coincidence or named after whatever. The name was more popular than I ever knew because when the internet was becoming popular, I typed in a search on my name, and then I found many more Orby Lees, which was hilarious to me. Because
did you ever find out where the name originated from?
No, I didn't. And it's interesting that I met more people. It came back around where people like the ring of it or something. Because I've heard of more.
Well, there are so many fascinating pictures in the book. You can see that your father is fair-haired like you are when he was young. This book is almost a hybrid between a coffee table book and a biography. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to do that hybrid approach to it?
You picked up on it, and not a lot of people do, but when we talk about it, I always say that it's a coffee table book with extensive text. You know, there's a ton. And the main goal was that there was so much information that we wanted to get out, and then the pictures ended up being so beautiful. And so having the big glossy feel of it really appealed to us, and to have the best of both worlds. The book was researched by a guy named Marcel Risco, and then we had the story, and then we had our family stories, and it really was great to have such a good team at Hachette, and along with our writer, Jeff Slate, that we synthesized everything through to get kind of the most readable, enjoyable page-turner of a book. But one prerequisite with all of us was that the size of it couldn't be diminished. And the book is 12 by 10, and it was like internally to go from a record size, which is 12 by 12, and they said, we need to make the book 12 by 10. And all of us started grumbling. And then we realized that almost no one's making books that are LP size, that 12 by 10 is the norm. So, yeah. And
the whole used to be 10-inch records.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah. Yeah, the whole process was too much fun. So it really was just a matter of wanting to cram everything in there.
Well, how did Roy first come into wanting to play music?
Let's see. Well, our dad asked for a guitar at the age of 6. And so our grandfather was a singer and a guitar player. And let's see.
And Mama's brother was also a guitar player, singer. And they would do those barn dances, you know, on the weekend and all. I think Daddy said he found out if you stayed with the musicians, you got to stay up later, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And with our dad, it's funny, the motivations are all these small little kernels. But our dad had asked for a harmonica. That's what it was. And then our grandpa had his harmonica fall out into a well and drain the well to get his harmonica back. So I don't know if it was just him really wanting to style out his son and get a guitar, or that trauma of losing and regaining that other harmonica, but he got him a guitar. And so if you do the math, our dad was born in 1936. So 1942 would be April 1942. World War II was on. And so he said there was like an energy of people that were either shipping out or didn't know if they were going to get shipped out or didn't know if the world was going to be here, you know, tomorrow. And so they would have, you know, guitar pull kind of celebration things at wherever, you know, in the living room of whoever's house or in the back. And then staying up late was the main motivation to get good, is staying up late to play that guitar.
Now, beyond like the guitar pulls and the house parties, when was the first time your dad played and got paid for it? When was his first professional gig?
As far as I remember, it was a high school dance, wasn't it? Where his buddy was his manager?
Yeah, the first big payday was the high school dance. The first dollar earned was a medicine show. It was literally a medicine show with like a guy with a wagon and elixirs, which is
patent medicines.
Starting to sound like that movie Big Fish to me. But yeah, that's, and his buddy carried his guitar and arranged it all up, and he tied for first place and then gave his buddy 50% for being his manager. So he learned a lot that day.
That's Colonel Tom Parker percentages right there.
It's pretty close. It's pretty close. Yeah. Yeah. I guess he learned a lot more. I think he was probably eight or so. He'd figured out more in 8 years than I had figured out in 20 years of living, you know, really was advanced.
Now, one Mr. John R. Cash gave your dad some terrible advice.
Yeah.
Yeah, change your name and lower your voice, and you might have a chance.
Yeah, because no one's ever going to buy anything from an Orbison.
And lower the voice, which, I mean, he's had one of the most iconic voices in popular music history.
Yeah, you know, they were such good pals at that time that was, you know, that's them too, probably stuck in a hotel and, you know, single beds or right down the street at Johnny's house here when he gave him that advice. Probably was really from the bottom of his heart advice of what had worked for John. You know, really had worked good for Johnny Cash. But, you know, when you read through my dad's story, it is amazing because what worked really well for everyone else did not work for him. And continually, over and over, he had to redirect and find his own way, which is something even me as a son didn't think about, you know, because I was born in 75. And Wesley's born in 65. So Wes is born in the Pretty Woman peak. And my dad was already so established and talented seeming that it just seemed like he always sang great. And, you know, the seas parted and he became Roy Orbison early and just stayed with it. But, you know, doing the research for this, you realize there's more peaks and valleys and lows in there that I had realized.
Well, and he thought he would come to Memphis, record for Sun, and become a superstar like all the other fellas
did. That's it. That's exactly. And same thing with Nashville, too. And both record deals that he had initially following Johnny and Elvis to Sun Records. And he did do great regionally with Ooby Dooby, but the follow-up didn't materialize. And then he kind of got promoted up to RCA in Nashville with the song Claudette for the Everly Brothers, and got a big contract there following Elvis, and literally stormed back out to move back home to Texas and then sell the Cadillac. And he said that was his lowest point of those days. And the Cadillac drove home, got in a dust storm, and it ate all the chrome off the front bumper. And so he got silver tape and redid the middle of the bumper so it looked like it still had chrome on there. And he said he would only show the car around 5:30 in the evening under the light at the pharmacy because it looked just right. And then he sold it. And whoever bought it, it got repossessed like 2 days later. and that was just before Only the Lonely. But you don't think about him going to RCA and then not having any singles and getting dropped off the label from where Elvis was, and then kind of being at home and, you know, not really, losing the faith or whatever. You know, he stayed with it, which is the important thing for
But it was his early sessions with Owen Bradley and Chet Atkins that was one of the things that helped define the Nashville sound.
It really was. It really was. And in a way, with that first setup, it was a little too much of the old Nashville sound. If you listen to the RCA, the demos or the tracks they cut, and they cut like six or seven songs. But my dad had a really soft feel, and Paperboy was probably his best song from that thing. And they got the backup singers are singing really loud over him, and it's
was it Anita Kerr on those?
No, that was it was the Jordanaires on the very first one, and it's a bunch of guys because they thought his voice was too thin, so they had him on top of him, and you lose that vulnerability or something. And then it was with Fred Foster that he fought for the strings after that session. Then he said, well, for you know. They had to drive through Memphis to get up to Nashville from Texas. And so Joe Melson and my dad had a lot of time to think about whatever was happening in the car on the drive up. But they said, you know, we want strings instead of fiddles, which fiddles was the real old Nashville sound. And then the new Nashville sound ended up being with the strings. And so it is very interesting because our dad's not country enough to be like diehard country, and then you know, he's not rock enough to be like you know, wild enough for a lot of the rockers, and so he had his own kind of subset of music. And so for the Nashville sound to be developed by someone who wasn't diehard country, you know, and the interesting thing is they say that he was one of the people that contributed to the Nashville sound. And so Uptown came in 1959. And Only the Lonely 1960, and immediately at the same exact time down the street was, I think it was Owen, and they were doing I'm Sorry and Only the Lonely, and there was the number one and two songs. They both had that strings and chorus kind of lush sound that we know now.
It was amazing seeing some of the posters and sleeves for the records that they had play up the hillbilly image when he was making some of the most sophisticated pop this side of New York.
I know. And so you struck at the root of why we want the book to happen so bad. It's between the miscommunication of a record company saying hillbilly rock, you know, when, you know, and it's funny because I saw an interview and my dad said hillbilly. None of us even knew what the hell that was, you know. But between that and then my dad did his own press until around Oh Pretty Woman. When Oh Pretty Woman took off, he didn't have time to answer every phone call. And so at that point, it became a little bit of the press just writing whatever they wanted about him and him just going to go play and record, not really being concerned with it. But yeah, the record sleeves are very interesting because they don't really reflect. And you can see a little bit of my dad had adopted his image with the dark hair and the dark shades, and the record sleeves kind of don't catch up for a little while because I think they were like scared to push the sunglass image or whatever. You know, I see a lot of the later records when it's him with the clear glasses, which is, you know, the Colonel Parker would have never dealt with that with Elvis. So you're going to get the right photo and the right thing and the right story and everything. And, you know, with us in A Cup Rose, it was a little bit more of a publisher manager. So he didn't have the whole thing branded out or something. So it is interesting. But it helps now to have the book. And when you lay it all out, it makes it a little easier to digest with a lot of the whys.
Now, you'd mentioned Claudette earlier. And mm-hmm. That's also the name of your mother, Wesley, mm-hmm. And
that's right.
Roy's first wife. How did they come to meet each other?
Oh, gosh. Well, I don't know exactly. I know there was a place called the Rock House that was a dance hall, if you will. And I think they...
Which became a hit on its own right.
Pardon?
Which that song named Rock House became
notable
on its own.
Yeah, I think it might have been about that old stone place where they used to dance at. Yeah, that's the best story I can remember, you know.
Now, it seemed... And I apologize for bringing up for a very tragic circumstance, but the world of rockabilly went through tragedy after tragedy.
Yeah.
With Buddy Holly, mm-hmm. Eddie Cochran, Johnny Burnett, and your family didn't remain untouched by that. And just two terrible tragedies, one mm-hmm. after the other, in the mid to late 60s.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is astounding that lightning struck twice. And it's almost... unfathomable, you know, seeing now, and I'm not a father yet, but I'm a proud uncle to Wesley's daughter and my brother Roy's son, Roy III. And yeah, just now we're old enough to really understand what that meant for our dad. It's hard to even understand how he made it through a lot of, you know, moving on, and that, you know, it is in all real tragedies, you know, you're picking up the pieces from the first event, and then the second wave comes, and you know, it is tragic. And honestly, that was the hardest part of the book, of course, to put in context and get the pieces, and just to go through and address it all. You know, it really is a lot. You know, we're working on a movie at this point, and a lot of the people, you know, the writers that we were talking to, they would say, "Where's the dirt? You know, was there drugs? Was your dad seeing other women?" And we always looked and said, "Look, man, the story on its own is crazy enough. Like, you won't have to get off into the weeds, because our dad wasn't that kind of a character. So, you know, the true story is actually very sad. And you know, even it goes a little further too. Things really do happen in threes most of the time. And so our Uncle Grady passed away. And that was before I was born, 73. 72,
that's about
73.
Right. 72 or 3.
Yeah. And so for us, it's that period there where our grandfather had a heart attack and Grady passed away. So that those years were very rough.
Yeah. So yeah, Papa's heart attack would be roughly 74. Mm-hmm. And then Dad's 78.
Yeah.
So yeah, there were some little bumps in the road mm-hmm. ever since those big tragedies.
But when he came out on the other side of those, you know, we think of Roy Orbison, the music is so haunting and touches the most sensitive and darkest chords within us.
Yeah.
But he seemed to be a fairly happy, well-adjusted person coming out on the other side of all this.
Yeah, yeah. You know, at the end of the day, you know, when you have such a big loss, it really does, I don't know, it makes you contemplate your own mortality in a way. And even just recently when my mom passed away and we all got together, you know, it's like life's too short. And that was the resounding thing that kind of repeated itself. It's just life's too short to not make the best of it and to do what you want to do, what makes you happy, what makes you fulfilled or satisfied. And at a deeper level. And so I can only guess that that would be the lesson that our dad had pulled out of that too.
Now, your mother, Barbara, how did your father and your mother meet?
So my mom was, she'd snuck out on a Saturday night and ended up from Germany. She ended up in Leeds, England, which is like, there was no tunnel then. So I imagine you had to take the train, and I don't know.
There's ferries from Hamburg, I think, that go over.
And the logistics of, you know, of getting, sneaking out on a Saturday night and making it to a discotheque in Leeds is crazy. You know, that just says a lot about how she was as a person and that tenacity. But the other guys were going out to the nightclub, and they said, "Roy, you got to get out." So they brought him, and it was cold out, so he grabbed a jean jacket from one of the guys, and then after, when he met my mom, then they started hitting it off. And then he said, "Hey, would you, you know, I'm doing a show tomorrow. Would you like to come to the show? We can have dinner afterwards." And she said, "Yeah, I would love to, but you have to promise me you're not going to wear that jacket. It is awful."
She was negging him.
Yeah, well, you know, a good heckle. You know, when you heckle someone, sometimes it's better than paying them a compliment, but it's their thing was there in a nutshell, you know, which is really, really is funny, that whole thing.
Now, almost at the same time as the book came out, a new album came out with the Royal Philharmonic,
yep.
A Love So Beautiful. How did that project come together?
That project started here in Memphis, in a way, because the... our producers, Don Reedman and Nick Patrick, had a huge, huge international hit with If I Can Dream, Elvis Presley and the Royal Philharmonic. And so after the Elvis record, we had heard it. It went to number one in the UK and did very, very well. And it just sounded fantastic. And so they called us and wanted to get together and discuss doing the Roy Orbison and Royal Philharmonic record. And in a way, it's perfect that they already had the second Elvis record in the hole. And so that put the Love So Beautiful record to come out now, which is fantastic to have a book and a record in this day and age. It's just been really, really nice to do together. And we also have a documentary that's coming soon, and we're working on the international part of it. But so soon it'll be the record and the book and the documentary all threading into each other, which is really nice, because as a family, curating the story is one of the big opportunities. And so with the book and documentaries, you can really it affords us to let people know what our dad was really like as a person, which he truly was a special character. And so that part of it's really fun for us. And the record, it's all the hits with new backing and new arrangements with the Royal Philharmonic, which is the difference is my dad had like anywhere from 4 to 8 to 12 to 16 sometimes strings on a record, and the Royal Philharmonic is a 75 piece. And with the new arrangements, it makes it sound so fresh and inspired. And
it really
so,
does sound fresh.
Yeah, yeah, which is, I mean, even, so we have the classic, you know, we took the original vocal off of In Dreams or something, and just the new context is put, it almost sounds like a new performance. It's so weird, but in a wonderful way, you know.
Well, we don't have too much time left, but I really want to put you on the spot now.
Good.
Today, at this moment, what's your favorite song of your father's?
Yeah, it changes on a daily basis, I would say. Today's going to be Working for the Man.
So. Mm. Yeah. So, and mine's You Got It Right Now. But it literally, if you asked yesterday, it would be something else. And tomorrow it would be something new as well.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today. The time has just rushed by, and it's been a real pleasure speaking with you.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate
Wesley
it.
And Alex Orbison are the authors, along with their brother Roy Jr., of The Authorized Roy Orbison, which is published by Center Street, a division of Hachette. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. We'd love to hear from our listeners. Email us at WYPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee 38111. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library and Information Center. All rights reserved.